I said, yeah, I can't think so small. Think big. You have the same amount of hours in the day, right? You have the same passion for something. Do something that actually has potential to be global and not just focused on a small group or even a small country.
You're listening to Ascending, the Olim Entrepreneurship Playbook, hosted by Alex Chandrovsky, an Aleph from San Francisco. Aliyah demands leaving the familiar, taking a risk and venturing towards the unknown. This podcast is a map that deconstructs the mindset and habits of Israel's most successful Olim.
I have the privilege of sitting with Nahum Kleinman, the CEO of Book Like a Boss in the headquarters of Book Like a Boss in Ramat Beit Shemesh, Israel. Nahum is an Ole in 2002 from Passaic, New Jersey. He was actually on the first flight of Nefesh B'Nefesh. Very exciting. Book Like a Boss, tell me a few words about this company. You guys have launched in 2017. You have 20,000 users from 100 countries.
Yeah.
And all bootstrapped.
Yeah, I mean, we did raise a little bit of money, but we still consider ourselves bootstrapped because we've turned down way more money than we've actually we've actually taken in. But it was a conscious decision just based on past experiences that we really wanted to take the company to, you know, a high level before we considered taking real funding. And hopefully we're still trying to not take large funding.
Got it. And where did the idea for Book Like a Boss come from?
That's a great question. So I was doing some business consulting, business coaching, and I came out with a book called The From Entrepreneur. And I
had excellent book.
Oh, thank you. And I had a podcast of the same name, interviewing from entrepreneurs from around the world. And what happened was because of my book and because of my podcast, I was getting emails almost daily from people and phone calls. Hey, can I pick your brain? Can I take you out for lunch? Can I buy you coffee?
Yeah.
And the whole back and forth of, oh, well, you know, I charge my time. Oh, how much do you charge? Oh, what does that include? It was just a lot of back and forth. Some people were expecting not to pay anything. Some people thought it was too much. Some people were happy to pay. But then if they were happy to pay, but when's a good time that we could both meet? And, you know, I said, you know, I wish there was a way, an easy way, where someone wants to book me, they make that first point of contact.
Book me like a boss.
Book me like a boss.
Right.
I wish there was like an easy way where I could just send them a link. And on the very first touch, you know, from the potential customer, that will take them to a web page that'll say, hey, this is who I am. Maybe have a video, information about me, testimonials, frequently asked questions, everything that that person needs in order to decide whether that person's going to book me. And if they do book me, they can see my calendar and they can pay me up front as well. That way there's no back and forth. That way there's no, oh, who are you? What, you know, what else have you done? What services do you offer? It was just everything in one place. And I realized there were a lot of calendar apps out there and scheduling apps, but there was nothing all in one that was simple and easy to use. And so as I'm thinking about this pain point, I tried building it on my own with WordPress because I'd built some WordPress sites before, but it wasn't, you know, when one app would get updated, would throw off the rest of the website and it didn't look good on mobile, and I just couldn't do it on my own. So I tried hiring a developer and they wanted like $3,000. I said, I don't want to spend $3,000 on this. And as I'm thinking about this pain point that I have, a friend of mine forwarded me an email from his sister who was a masseuse. And she said, hey, I live in Efrat. I'm looking for an easy to use website or web page builder that I could say, hey, these are the massages I offer. Here's my calendar. Allow my clients to book me and pay for it all from one place. Does such a thing exist? And when I read that, that's when the light bulb went off. I said, hey, if I as a business consultant has this need, and she as a masseuse has this need, with the growing gig economy and the way things are going, millennials, 50% of millennials have their regular job and their side hustle. I said, I said, I bet there's a real opportunity here for some for an easy-to-use platform that makes it simple to sell services online. And then a good friend of mine, my partner, Dov Yudkowitz, who's a master programmer who I've worked with before in previous projects, he became available. I pitched him the idea. I guess this was February, March 2016. He loved it, and we started building it.
Wow, amazing, amazing. And then tell me a little bit about just the thought process of how do you decide on the features that you were going to include, right? It's a building process. So how do you prioritize what you're going to offer first, second, third?
So that's a great question, because it's still a challenge even three years later. We're always making decisions on what are we going to work on now? What are we going to build now? In the beginning, I based it just on my personal needs as a business coach. You know, what are the things that I actually need in order to solve the pain points that I was having? And so the first set of features were all based on that. When we launched in June 2017, we launched with a company called AppSumo, and which is a deal site run by a friend of mine, Noah Kagan. Uh-huh. And he has a huge audience, over a million people, and it was a great way to get our software noticed. And we went from something like, I don't know, like 200 users to over 5,000 in 3 weeks. Uh-huh. And so once we had those 5,000 users, they gave us tremendous feedback, and we kept track.
Is it okay if I just stop you for 1 second? So sure. Just that initial customer acquisition process, AppSumo was basically a reseller for your services, and they took a cut. Is that how the relationship works?
They're like Groupon, you know.
They're Groupon for apps.
Yeah, they're Groupon for apps.
Okay.
So they have the audience. They present specials and deals that people had signed up for. And so, yeah, they get a cut of whatever we sell through their list. They help promote it and market it, and it was a great way to really launch us.
Yeah.
And so, we kept track of all the feedback from our users now, that told us, hey, we want this feature, we want that feature, and basically we decided on user feedback what was going to be the next set of features we were going to build.
How do you track user requests?
So we have a Facebook group. We actually have over 4,000 bosses. We call users bosses. So we have over 4,000 bosses in our Facebook group. So we tag them when we use intercom. So when people put a request in, we tag the request. And when we start to see multiple requests for the same thing, then we use Trello and we'll actually make a card in Trello and put it in our to-do list. And we work from our to-do list to then, you know, bring it to development.
Awesome. So what I love about what you're saying is that this constant conversation with customers for feedback.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And that's, I think so many businesses can learn from you about that, is that notion of, well, I'll just build it and they'll come, right? Or I think in Israel, there's this interesting phenomenon where the business owner is doing a favor at times to the customer by giving him a service. It's a fascinating phenomenon, which I've found to be very interesting to encounter. It's like, do you understand I'm giving you money? It's like, I know you're giving me money to the business owner, but you don't have my priorities right here. So that is such an amazing process of let's have that 5,000 individuals who are beta users. Let's ask what they're thinking. Let's try to prioritize what the biggest requests are, and we'll work through them step by step. So it's like just classic, 100%. Beautiful. I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
Boom.
And I actually wrote a blog post on LinkedIn. Someone introduced me to a VC. It was a smaller VC, and I'm really anti-VC.
Just those two letters or something? To present? It's like, I don't use the word V and C. Those letters.
Those two letters, forget it.
Yeah, that's right.
No, venture capital. I'm not really pro venture capital. I mean, it has its use cases and I can understand it, but as an entrepreneur and bootstrap startup, you know, I want to stay away from them. Plus, I've raised millions of dollars from VCs, from previous companies with them, but their goals and their alignment is different than an entrepreneur's. And, So someone made an introduction, and it was a smaller VC, so I went to speak to them. And they weren't really interested in the fact that we were so in tune with our users. They were more interested in coming up with something from a technological standpoint that can give you, you know, that something that we could patent or something that we could make into something unique. And I told the VC straight out, I said, listen, we are all about our customers, our users. We're all about giving our users the best experience and giving them what they want. Yes, as we grow as a company, there'll be technological advances. And yes, I have a lot of ideas of what we can do from a technology standpoint. But right now, as a startup, you know, right now it's all about the users. And I think that's how it's always going to be. If you can take care of your users, you can make them happy and give them what they want, you're just going to grow organically, which is really what we've seen. And we grew to over 20,000 users, mostly organically. We've spent less than $10,000 on marketing. Wow. in the last 2.5 years. So it's really been a lot of word of mouth, and people just really love the product.
So we're going to geek out a little bit here.
Sure.
I tell Nahum there's like hours of what we can talk about because he's such a fascinating personality. But I just want to like just jump in a little bit more into the SaaS world because it's also a big reality in Israel. People are building a SaaS product. What just excites you about a SaaS product as a business? Because you've been involved in a lot of games.
Yeah, and I've actually said this before. It's not my first Milchin Cholent.
There's a context to that joke. Yeah.
But what fascinating, and I've actually said it recently that if I build any other company again, you know, once Book Like Boss exits, it's still going to be the SaaS model.
Okay.
I fall in love with it, and it's growing. I think I just read I think it's going to be $160 billion by 2022. Huge industry. The fact that you can, you know, when you're working with a physical product, you have to worry about shipping. You have to worry about handling, manufacturing, and importing and exporting, and all these different things. With software, you can make an update, and whether you have 200 people or 2 million people, the update goes out to everybody, right? You don't have to worry about manufacturing or shipping or storage or anything like that. Also, the fact that it's subscription-based, you know how much money you have coming in per month or per year, and you can make proper projections based on actual things that you're doing.
Just to add to Nahum's point is that I come from the food industry, and I was meeting with a very prominent company in Israel that was producing a food tech product. I can't go into details, but it said it takes 6 months to change one ingredient in the product because of all the regulation, right?
So, wow.
Imagine a SaaS product takes 6 months to change one element of that recipe. So yeah, so essentially it's scalable, it can move and respond to the market quite quickly, and also it's a predictable revenue model.
Yes, absolutely. And when you find the pain point, if you're able to solve a pain point in a big enough market, the world is really, you know, your customer. You know, from the very beginning, I built it with the intention of making it global. We're in 6 different languages: Spanish, German, French, Dutch, English, and Italian. And we're in 23 different currencies. And we have users in over 100 different countries. And we when building a company from today, yeah, I wanted to have that foundation in place. And you know, some of my partners felt maybe we should just concentrate in English. But no, when you build something today, and I just told it to another entrepreneur I was speaking to who's still struggling with trying to find, you know, his niche, what he wants to do. I said, yeah, I can't think so small. Think big. You have the same amount of hours in the day, right? You have the same passion for something. Do something that actually has potential to be global and not just focused on a small group or even a small country. Even here in Israel, most, you know, when anybody's building SaaS, they're not building it for Israelis. They're building it for the global world.
Yeah.
And I think that's something very important here in Israel. To think globally, not locally.
And I think with that being said, you are also very clear about your customer target. Meaning, like, while you're building globally, you have a very clear, small customer segment that you're going after, which is bosses.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to know your niche. And when it comes to your product, I mean, you're supposed to try and focus on one specific customer and target your marketing towards that one specific customer. That's something I haven't been good at just because, you know, as soon as we got those first 5,000 customers, now over 20,000, it's just such a broad range. Men, women, all different ages, countries, languages, and all different positions. Like our number one seller, the one that we've done millions of dollars through our software, the number one seller is actually a barber, right? And so, you know, we didn't know, I mean, probably has like 4 or 5 or 6 barbers working for him. But we have barbers, we have marketers, we have therapists, we have accountants, lawyers, electricians, plumbers, clowns, singers. I mean, really anything out there that people sell a service.
Now, we're talking about clowns or we're talking about bosses that are just clowns? which one
is it? No, real clowns.
Real clowns.
Real clowns.
Their service is being a clown.
Being a clown, exactly.
That is what they're doing.
Yeah. We love our bosses. We would never call them clowns.
I understand. So, guys. So,
unless they're, of course, a clown.
And then we pride call them exactly
right,
that.
Right, exactly.
Unless it's an it, and therefore, yeah, unless we have that. So can you explain to me a little bit about just that natural scale, right? So we have our first group of, say, 200 individuals, then we scale up to 5,000 through using a partnership with, say, Groupon model, and then we want to get to 5,000 to 20,000. How does that go?
focus on the customer, right? We spent the next 12 months after we got those 5,000 not on trying to get more customers, but on creating value for those initial 5,000 customers. So we also had an affiliate program, and you know, we have over 1,500 people that promote us and market us.
Is there a certain site that you guys use as a partner site for affiliate marketing that you don't mind sharing just for other bosses?
So right now we've actually closed it off.
Okay, so you don't have to share.
Yeah. Right? I mean, it's partners.booklikeaboss.com, but now what happened was we did a partnership with another company that focuses on affiliate marketing, and so we sort of closed off our affiliate program to only users of our software. So if you're not a user of our software, then you have to. Then we send you to Commission Junction. If you are a user of our software then, and you want to promote us, then definitely contact us and we'll set you up.
Okay, got it. Okay, yeah. Perfect. So then the growth is focused on the
core. It's a lot of word of mouth, because what we did was also, these 5,000 people that came in, they had on their pages powered by Book Like a Boss, right? And whenever they got a booking, it said powered by Book Like a Boss. When an email reminder went out, when an email confirmation went out, powered by Book Like a Boss. If they embedded their calendars on their own website, powered by Book Like a Boss, right? So because we had 5,000 users now that were using us, people were saying, oh, wow, this is cool. Oh, I want this page. I want this also. That's how we got a lot of our traffic. And still to today, that's how we get a lot of our traffic. Mm-hmm. It's the old Hotmail model, right? Hotmail, when they when they give out their free email accounts, they always said, like, powered by Hotmail or get your Hotmail, right? Get your free Hotmail account. And that's how they were able to balloon. It's a tactic a lot of SaaS companies use. And, you know, now as we've grown, we have two levels. So some people don't want to promote you, and so they pay us a little more, and then they can remove our branding. Mm-hmm. And then there are those that are happy to promote you, pay less, and we get a lot of traffic like that as well.
And what's the biggest feedback people are giving in terms of the value of the product to them?
I think the we pride ourselves on being ease of use, and people find us really easy to use. Like, a lot of what we do, you could try to do on your own. As I said, I tried doing it on WordPress. You could try to do it with Wix. You could try doing it with other website builders.
Yep.
But even with those, it takes hours and hours and days sometimes to build a site and maintain. We make it simple. You know, it's easier than drag and drop. It's basically filling out a form, and we have videos that walk you through every step of the way. So we knew a lot of our users are not really into technology, don't understand technology, don't want to understand technology. So we built it in a way that was easy for anybody to use.
Okay. And how do you build credibility for the user? For example, you know, that they are an individual that they can trust. Right? How does the user build that through your product?
Oh, I mean, so we look at it as, you know, as if they're building their own website. They have every person has their own customer base, or they have their own social media accounts and connections and network and their own ways of promoting and marketing themselves. When they send our link to people, or they promote our link, and they could use their own link, they could use their own domain name, right? It has a very professional look and feel to it, and so, you know, people tend to trust it. But it's about the people themselves. I mean, we give them some marketing tools like coupons, and we have some other marketing tools that are going to be coming out. But it's really the people themselves that use their own network to promote their business as they do today.
So how much business has been booked through Book Like a Boss to date?
The last I've looked, we've had probably about $1.5 million that we've seen booked, meaning that we allow people to connect their Stripe accounts or credit cards, PayPal. So we're able to calculate that. So we call that online bookings. Mm-hmm. So we've done probably like $1.5 million. Mm-hmm. And then we've also seen another $1.5 million to $2 million more done offline. But since we don't know that the money actually goes through or not, because the payment's done offline, some of it could be test accounts or people testing the sales, or maybe some of them didn't close. But you know, I'd say we've done more than $2 million in sales through the site.
As a small SaaS company, right, that's just bootstrapping, how do you deal with a bigger competitor? I mean, that's what people ask. How do you deal with a bigger competitor which is going to say, okay, I'm looking at what they're doing, Book Like a Boss, seems like they're doing well, I see they're growing. Why don't I just copy exactly what they're doing? How do you prevent yourself from doing, say, what Instagram did with Snapchat?
Right. So, I mean, you can't live a SaaS company with that thought in mind. I mean, a lot of VCs also, they ask the question, what happens if Google does this or LinkedIn does that? You know, you can't worry about the competitors so much. one of the things that we did is we keep a lot of what we're doing close to our chest until we actually launch it. And there are things we've done that we've seen our competitors do and copy us a year later, right? But when you're able to be nimble and you're able to stay ahead of the game, you're going to do well. Plus, it's a huge market as well. But it was a very conscious decision, even from a marketing standpoint. We wanted people to think that we're just another scheduling app that has some features that no one else has. But that's not really where we want to be. We don't want to be known as a scheduling app. Where we're going and where we're aiming for, we want to be the Shopify for services. We want to be that if you sell a service, you're using our software to sell that service, right? Just like with a physical product, you can either sell it in a marketplace like Amazon or Etsy or eBay, right? Or you have your own website, such as using Shopify or WooCommerce or BigCommerce, et cetera, right? So when selling a service, you could join other marketplaces, but then you're just competing with hundreds of other people, and you have to, you know, it is very, very hard to run a business, a marketplace business. But if you want to sell on your own, if you're good at marketing, if you have your own network, and everybody has their own network today, you know, through social media and, you know, events, LinkedIn, et cetera, you don't want to compete with thousands of others. You want to build your own network of customers and clients. So our goal and vision is really to be that Shopify for services. So, but we don't tell that anywhere. We don't say that anywhere. And I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, don't tell any of our competitors. But, you know, when we list our competitors on our website, if you go to the footer of our page, and you'll see we have Calendly and Schedule Once and 10 to 8 and a bunch of others. But we know where we're going, and you're going to see some of these changes. I'm happy to talk about them now because a lot of these changes are happening sooner than later. We're going to start breaking away even more. And people will stop looking at us as a scheduling app and looking at us more as a software for services, which is really where we want to go. But, you know, when it comes to... one of the things that people love about us is our brand, Book Like a Boss. And, you know, if you look at any of our competitors, none of them has a Facebook group with 4,000 users, right? 4,000 members. We are building a community, and we're building it together with the users. When you listen to your users and you offer them, like we offer a lot of content, educational content to them. We do webinars with other well-known people, Peter Shankman and other well-known people in different areas of marketing and sales. And we look at our bosses, they're like family. And so when you treat them like family, they realize that, and then they're committed to you and they want to help you grow. And that's another way to differentiate yourself between you and your customers. People don't think, hey, what's so thrilling about a scheduling app? Well, Book Like a Boss is thrilling. People love us and people feel like they're part of a community.
Plus, you get to wear those cool glasses.
Yes.
If you get to that place, right?
That's right.
Two other questions just following up before we move on to the next stage. In terms of the product itself, right, how long does it take? What's the startup cost of something like this? I don't know if you could share with that. How do you get through as a bootstrap company? We talk about friends and family. Is it savings? Is it a loan? Like, if a company is not looking for VC money, what were the avenues that you as an individual who's trying to build up a SaaS company, how do you bootstrap?
So it's, one, you need a crazy entrepreneur, and two, you need a dedicated developer. I'm a crazy entrepreneur. I even talk about this in my book a little bit, about how I take risks for the greater good, you know, for what I believe in. And so, yeah, you know, it's struggling the first couple of years. You're not making a salary. You know, the first year and a half, we didn't get any salary. And so you have to say, hey, are you willing to do that? You know, my partners were able to take side hustles, doing development and design on the side, and so they were able to exist somewhat. But we all put in sweat equity, right? If you don't have the ability to put in that sweat equity, then you're going to be in trouble, right? Like I have another friend who wants to build a SaaS company, but he doesn't have a developer on board that's willing to put in that sweat equity. So he has to come up with the money or the funding in order to pay software developer. So it's not so easy because, you know, really good developers have jobs and they don't think outside the box, and they're just happy to get, a high salary, and maybe they'll get a little piece of the company or not. So to find that developer that is entrepreneurial enough and willing to take that risk is very unique. So I got very lucky with that. Having my partner David, who's a fantastic programmer, developer, you know, buy into the vision, believe in me, and, you know, work together to really launch and grow this company. But that being said, it is easier today to start a SaaS company than before, than let's say even 10 years ago, just because if you're able to get that first MVP out and you're able to solve a pain point, and there's a lot of marketing things you can do that don't cost you money, you know, it is easier than it was, you know, in the past. But one other thing I want to reiterate, though, is that it is still very challenging, you know, besides the fact that you're not making normal salaries, right? And so you're sort of losing money, personal money, every month, you know, for years at a time. And there's personal sacrifice, there's family sacrifice, which we could talk about. But also, the most frustrating thing for me is that, you know, as a visionary and as a people pleaser, I want to give my customers everything on day one, right? And so it is very frustrating, and it's been one of the biggest challenges not to be able to develop as fast as you want to develop, not be able to, you know, get out new features as fast as you want. Now, in order to get that done faster, I could raise money and I could hire more developers and then we could do things faster, but then you're giving up a piece of your company. So it's that fine line.
Those two words, two letters, VC.
Yeah, exactly. But it's, you know, if you want to maintain control of your company and you want to be able to make decisions, then there's a sacrifice to pay for that. Thank God we've had consistent growth since we launched, in terms of revenue, in terms of users, in terms of everything. We've seen it consistently. And we know that if we put in some extra cash now, we could probably grow that even faster. So now we are actually raising a little bit of money. We've raised some and probably going to raise a little bit more because, you know, we've gotten to a point where we're going to end up losing more by not moving faster than by the small equity we're going to have to give in. Plus, the valuation of our company is higher than it would be as a startup with just friends and family because we already have users, happy users, customers, solve the pain point, and now it's just really about scaling.
Got it. Can we talk for the last couple of minutes about family and entrepreneurship? What you mentioned there was, I think, a really powerful point, which is we have to understand that there's a tremendous toll entrepreneurs need to take for the first year, 2 years, or maybe 2.5 years. And one of the things that's from entrepreneurs, I think, differentiates us from potentially some young entrepreneurs in places like San Francisco is that we do have families, we have responsibilities. I think you mentioned number 8.
Yeah.
And your 8 is a very special number in Judaism. It also happens to be how many children it has. So can you share a little bit about conversation that a family has to have between, you know,
I'll tell you like this.
My wife, how do I, you know, get everybody, those stakeholders into play?
Right.
I mean, Danny's not getting those shoes this month because the usage dropped.
No. Right. There's two things here. One is you always have to keep in mind that the results are not in our hands, right? There's en koach biyadi. There's no strength in our hands, meaning we could put in our efforts and do our best, but whether you're going to be successful or not, whether you're successful, whether you fail, it's all in God's hands, right? So keeping that at the forefront of your mind allows you to say, you know what, it's better and more important that I could go spend time with my kid and go to his, you know, his sitter party than it means being in the office and spending another hour working, right? It also means that, you know, there are things that are not shakable, such as minyan, you know, davening 3 times a day, such as, you know, having a learning seder. Right? These are non-negotiable because this is what real life is about. Real life is about your connection to God, connection to your family. And yeah, building a business is that would come in third next to God and family, right? So, you know, keeping those perspectives in mind, there are challenges that happen. But that's another reason why we decided to bootstrap and why even being an entrepreneur, I think, is fantastic for the from person because you're allowed to take off for Chol HaMoed and not work. You don't have to answer to anybody else. You could take off and go to your kid's sitter party or take off for holidays or leave work early, you know, on Fridays, and you don't have to have these challenges because you're your own boss, right? So I think entrepreneurship, and we see that more in the Jewish community, in the frum community, in the last 10 years, more than the previous 30, right? It used to be that frum Jews would be accountants and lawyers and doctors and professionals and to be able to make a living. Today, you can't make a living on $200,000 a year, right? So entrepreneurship has been growing in the frum community. There's a lot more. There's magazines dedicated to it. There's a lot more investors. There's a lot more hubs and, you know, in Israel and in the States, you know, dedicated to Frum entrepreneurs. You know, I've been an advocate for Frum entrepreneurship for many years now, because it is very in tune with the lifestyle of somebody that says, hey, I want to put God first. I want to put family first. But I still want to use my talents and my skills and my drive and my passion to do something I enjoy doing and to build a business. That being said, you know, it's hard because, like, I enjoy entrepreneurship so much. I enjoy building a business. I enjoy interacting with customers and marketing and sales and working with my team, that it's sometimes hard to stop. Uh-huh. Right? So you got to put, you know, and that's why you, like, you try to put foundations in place. Okay, I have my Seder in the morning. I have my davening. Then I have my Kiyun Masechta Shir. I go to where we learn every piece, you know, 7 or 8 times over a course of a week. And, you know, so I have my learning as a foundation. And then I also have, you know, my kids' time, which is usually from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., which is not really that great because that's like prime time, East Coast time for customers and other stuff. But, you know, I try to make sure that I have time every day for the kids and the family. And then, you know, a lot of times I'm up late, you know, 11, 12, 1 a.m., you know, reading or doing customer response, et cetera. But so it's a challenge. I can't say I always am successful, again, because of the drive and the passion for business. But I try to put things in place that helps, you know, give me those borders.
Do you mind sharing a little bit about how does your spouse support you?
Oh, yeah, that was the other thing I was going to say.
It's really interesting to me because that's how does she
right.
deal with highs and lows of entrepreneurship?
Absolutely. So,
right? What kind of personality does a spouse of somebody need to have in order to be able to be, assuming that it works because, again,
yeah, no, this was the other
years?
Thing. 20.
That's an unbelievable number. That's a startup.
It's an unbelievable number for her. She's you know, I got lucky in this relationship. No, I actually write about this in my book.
Good looks can only keep you there.
Exactly.
Long enough.
I write about this in my book, and it's really a key to any successful entrepreneur, is that you have to have a partner that is willing to support you and back you in what you do. And I have to be honest, you know, entrepreneurship is not easy. It is a lot of sacrifice. I remember, you know, one of my anniversaries, I was in San Francisco speaking at Microsoft, and instead of being home with my wife celebrating our anniversary, that was, I think, the only anniversary I missed being with her. But, and there's also been a lot of times where you know it's time to pay electricity bill and the lights are shut off, right? When you really don't have money for food. And that's why I say when I was younger, I took a lot more risks, even married, even with a few kids. You know, I would go long stretches without any money coming in because I believed in my vision. I believed in my idea. I believed in building a company. And, you know, it takes a lot of sacrifice to do that. But without my wife in 20 years of all the ups and downs, never once did she ever say, hey, maybe you should get a job. Never once did she say, hey, maybe this isn't cut out for you. Hey, maybe you should try something else. She has been my biggest supporter, my biggest fan, the wind beneath my wings. And I could not be an entrepreneur and be a successful entrepreneur without her. And there's no question. And the fact is she's also an amazing mother. You know, 8 children is not easy. 9 if you include me, right? Yeah, it's not easy. It's more than a full-time job. But without having that backing, there's no way I could do it. And I tell new entrepreneurs, I tell all the time that I tell them a few things. One, if you're not able to, you have to have money in the bank for how long it's going to take for you to launch your endeavor, because not everybody can go months and months and months without knowing where money is going to come in from. It's not an easy thing to do. I'm crazy enough to do that, so I've done that a few times, but it's not for everybody. So I tell them, make sure you have money in the bank. And two, you have to have your spouse on board. If your wife or your husband is not there to back you with your endeavor, then besides all the normal challenges and the ups and downs come with entrepreneurship, if you have a family situation which is also going up and down, it makes everything 10 times worse. The fact that I have the support of my wife and, you know, and my children to a large extent is what enables me to make the sacrifice to start a company and grow it and to bootstrap it and, you know, B'zat Hashem, have it be successful.
Last question. When you're speaking to your spouse, or maybe if you're dating, right, and you know you have the personality of entrepreneurs, what you want to do, would you recommend some questions that should be discussed? how do you have a conversation with a spouse like this? Like, you know, from the numerous times you've had these conversations, can you give some tips to entrepreneurs who are married, to either husband or wife who's an entrepreneur, saying, honey, this is just realize this is, how do you feel about this? Where do you stand? How do you really have a conversation that's so honest?
It's best if you know who you are before you get married. It's best to have that conversation before you're married. I told my wife three things before we got married that I wanted her to be perfectly clear on. One, I told her, I said, I'm not your typical black hatter, meaning I wear a black hat and I'm what's called quote unquote Haredi, but I don't believe in labels, right? So, but my relationship with God is very real and the most important relationship I have. But I may not fit into the mold of a cool little guy. That was one thing I told her. The second thing I told her was that I can never work for anybody. I just don't have that in me, the ability to be able to work for somebody else and make them money. And the third thing I told her I was overweight, which she seemed surprised at, even though we'd met quite a few times before we decided to get married. No, I'm just kidding. No, I told her, I did tell her that. I said, I am overweight. And she's like, no. But anyway, it was a joke.
No. I was like, fascinating.
No, I really did.
The first two, I was like, interesting. The third was like, fascinating.
I did tell her to that, but she obviously knew that just because, you know, it's not something you can really hide.
I'm just wearing a suit. It's a little bigger than I really am.
Exactly. I made it very clear, and you know, that this is who I am, and she accepted that. And again, in all through our marriage, it's never been an issue because she knew that coming in. She knows who I am, and it's just incredible to have such an amazing wife behind me that enables me to do and be who I am and doesn't hold me back from being who I am. I had a friend, I'll tell you, I had a very good, very good friend of mine who it actually harmed our relationship when he, you know, at one point in one of my struggles, he said, you know, maybe you should get a job. Maybe you should give up on this entrepreneurship thing. And this was a very close friend of mine. And it pained me so much that it actually made made a big wedge in between our relationship. And it wasn't until a few years later when he saw us being successful and he says, you know what, you were right, I was wrong, and I should have believed in you, right? It's the worst thing to have somebody that doesn't believe in you. If you're passionate about something, you have something that's your goal and you want to do, you want to build, to have somebody try to knock you down. Again, if it's a critic, if it's a, you know, somebody, but if it's a friend or a relative, it's very, very hard to deal with. But a million times more if it's a spouse. So again, I can't reiterate enough having, you know, your spouse on board with you, and that I'm only who I am today because of my wife, and I'm so grateful to her.
Amazing. Well, I'm so grateful you were able to share with me. I think that both the technical growth that you've experienced and also just, I think, as a firm entrepreneur, family is such a key point to us. You know, our relationship with Hashem is so important. I think that in Israel specifically, I think that religion and families are the core of a lot of the issues. We don't have so much separation of church and state, and also family and business is not as much.
Right.
And I think that coming in terms of the reality of this, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, but also I have these other really core values of my relationship with a higher purpose and also my relationship with my family. Those have to be all aligned for us to be successful entrepreneurs.
Absolutely. I told someone else once, I said, when after 120 years, when I die, I don't want it to say on my tombstone, he built, you know, the biggest, scheduling app in the world, you know, or he built Book Like a Boss. Book Like a Boss is a means to an end, right? I'm passionate about entrepreneurship, and I'm passionate about building things and vision, and I'm passionate about what I could do with a successful exit. But my focus and goals and really want to come out of this world is not, I don't want to be known as an entrepreneur. I want to be known as somebody that helped, you know, build Klal Yisrael and helped do things for Klal Yisrael and had a heart for other people and did chesed. And really this, you know, the business and it is really means to the end. And if you ever lose focus and if you ever think that, oh my gosh, you know, I want to be the biggest businessman or biggest entrepreneur, you're probably on the wrong path. You got to keep, as you just said, and kudos to you, you know, God and family always has to come first. Those are the purposes why we're in this world. And entrepreneurship and business is just a means to an end.
And I do want to close this out by sharing with you something very special about Nahum that he shared with me that we have in common.
Ooh.
that we are both have a background that started entrepreneurship in the food business. And I do want to close this out with the greatest invention that you, Book Like the Boss is not going to be at your Hespit, but there's going to be something else. Can you just share like a quick word about Gamzus.
Yeah, and I went to a restaurant, I'll make it quick, in Mea Shearim. I was the first and last pizza place on Rehov Mea Shearim. How it happened, crazy story. But I came up, I originally wanted to open up a meat place, like a hamburger hot dog type place for Americans in the Mir Yeshiva. It was, you know, a 5-minute walk away. But the Bedatze Nacharedis was the only hechsher in town. They would, no other hechsher would come into Mea Shearim. And they wouldn't give me a hechsher on a fleishik place. So I had a milchik place. But I always had this dream of Thursday night, all-you-can-eat cholent and beer. So I invented something called cholent chalavi, which was potatoes, barley, fried onions, beans, and mozzarella and butter. And it was so good. It was so delicious. But I couldn't sell any of it. Not one person would buy it. And towards the end of the night, I tried giving it away to, you know, 50 people. Nobody would even take it for free. They just couldn't wrap around their heads around this idea of having a milchadika cholent. But don't mock it till you try it. It's actually really good. And it's a great Shavuos treat.
I think it's a great also example of customer fit.
Yeah.
Because in San Francisco, that thing would fly like Book of the Boss worldwide.
That's it.
Thank you so much.
Alex, thank you.